Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Welcome back to New Books in Political Science, a podcast on the New Books Network. I'm Susan Liebel at St. Joseph's University, and today I'm pleased to be joined by Suzanne Mettler and Robert C. Lieberman to discuss their new book, Four Threats, The Recurring Crises of American Democracy, published by St. Martin's in 2020. Rob C. Lieberman is a Krieger Eisenhower Professor of Political Science at the Johns Hopkins University. He's the author of Shaping Race Policy, The United States in Comparative Perspective, and Beyond Discrimination, Racial Inequality in a Post-Racist Era. Welcome to New Books, Rob.
Thanks very much.
Suzanne Mettler is the John C. L. Senior Professor of American Institutions in the Government Department at Cornell University. She's the author of five books and a veteran of the New Books Network. She talked with Heath Brown about the government-citizen disconnect most recently, and also our editor-in-chief in Everything, Marshall Poe, about degrees of inequality, how the politics of higher education sabotage the American dream. Welcome back to New Books, Suzanne.
Oh, delighted to be here again.
Your book raises important questions for American politics, especially in November 2020, as we record this conversation. Donald Trump has refused to concede the presidential election to Joe Biden or begin the official transition process. The book's dramatic opening draws parallels between the policy and rhetoric of John Adams as he supported the Alien and Sedition Acts amidst bitter party rivalry in the 1790s, and Donald Trump's targeting of immigrants, the press, and his political opponents. The book uses five periods in American political history to argue that there are four central threats to American liberal democracy: political polarization, racism and nativism, economic inequality, and excessive executive power. You maintain that the United States has faced earlier threats, or even combinations of these threats. And though we might imagine that previously facing these challenges proves the resiliency of American democracy, you suggest that past periods of conflict have had serious, long-term consequences for the robustness of American political institutions and practices. Moreover, you suggest the beginning of the 21st century is unique in that we see all four threats a serious threat to democracy. Book seeks to make sense of these threats using political science and history, but also sensitize voters to a critical moment, one that requires them to consider candidates and policy in light of whether democracy will be strengthened or weakened by their choices. Before we talk about the five periods and the four threats, I'd like to ask you about your collaboration. You've both written alone and collaborated with others. The two of you have authored the Oxford Handbook of American Political Development, along with Richard Valley. But how did the two of you come to this subject, and how did you go about writing this book together?
Well, it's been quite a process. Rob and I have known each other for a long time, as both being scholars of American political development and having related interests, and we've been friends for a long time. We're both also people who have been instructors on our campuses for the big lecture classes on Introduction to American Politics. And both of us had taught it when we were first out of grad school in the 90s and then came back to it in more recent years. And we both had the experience that it was like coming back to teaching about a different country, because so much had changed. Polarization had grown so much. And, you know, the institutions really seemed to be struggling. And then we got to the 2016 election. And suddenly, I know that I felt that it was a mind-bending experience. Even topics that seemed well-established, like the legitimacy of elections in the United States and the fact that they are, you know, not permeated by fraud and people agree to that, that came into question. So did the freedom of the press and all sorts of topics. And as I was struggling to catch up with this and reframing my lectures and rethinking things, I would find myself in conversations with colleagues of mine who study countries around the world where democracy has been deteriorating. And they seemed to understand what was going on in the United States better than I did. They had a language and analytical framework for thinking about it. And what they would say was terrifying to me. They would say things like, well, you know, democracies, they come and they go. And we've had a good run in the United States, and democracies don't last forever. And I was rather stunned by this and felt that I needed to learn from them. And at the same time, I was having conversations with Rob about political history in the United States, which both of us study. And we were wondering, has the United States really encountered this kind of danger in the past? And what does that tell us about the kind of danger we're in now? So early in 2017, together we started the American Democracy Collaborative with other scholars who study, who are comparative politics scholars who study the deterioration of democracies worldwide, and other scholars of American political development, particularly our friend Rick Vallely. And we started having conferences and workshops. And this book grew out of that. So we decided at some point we needed to write a book. We're going to do it together. And we worked really hard learning about these periods in history that we hadn't studied before. And it's been a great collaborative process. I often say that when I read a draft, you know, after a while, I don't know who wrote which sentences, because I think we have a similar writing style. But I've learned so much from Rob along the way, and it's been a great adventure.
That's what a great story, especially about forgetting your sentences. As you were, so this book came out of teaching, which is a sort of an interesting idea of sort of realizing where the country was because you were presenting it to your students. I'm wondering, as you were writing the book, were the students the intended audience? Were you thinking about policy leaders? Were you thinking about political scientists? So one question is about who the intended audience for the book is. And also, I know it's very hard to promote a book in a pandemic, but I'm wondering what kind of responses you've already gotten from what audiences and whether it's what you expected or something quite different.
Well, we deliberately set out to write a book that was not just another political science monograph. We were intentionally writing for a broader audience, I think partly for our students, but more generally for, you know, educated readers who have an interest in American history and in contemporary politics and who were, like us, struggling to make sense of what's been a very challenging and unsettling few years in American politics. And we've actually been very pleased at the response to the book. We've presented it to a number of different kinds of audiences, both academic audiences at universities, and more general audiences through podcasts and you can't have a classic book tour in a pandemic, but through a variety of media. And I think it resonates with people. People are grasping for some way of understanding what's been unfolding in the United States, you know, not just in the last 4 years, but as we try and chart in the book, really over the last several decades, as these threats have been growing and converging to bring us to what's been really a crisis in the last few years. So, you know, I would say that was one of the more challenging things about writing the book, you know, as scholars and as professional political scientists, where we're trained to write in a very particular way and in a very narrow and constrained way. And there's a lot of sort of jargon and inside chatter that goes on in professional writing. And at least for me, I think one of the most challenging things and one of the most interesting things about writing the book was trying to push that stuff off to the side or into the footnotes at the very least, and let the prose, the text of the book, really tell a story. And one of the things we discovered as we were researching these amazing periods of history that we write about is once you sort of line up what happened in these periods, the narrative almost just writes itself. It's an incredibly powerful way of telling the story of American democracy, just to tell these very particular stories. So I think all of that, you know, was a way for us to take what we've studied and learned over long careers now and try and translate it into something that citizens and interested observers could really grab onto.
I thought you were really successful. I liked the way you would use the political science-y term, but then explain it in very, very accessible, but not a simple way. And I thought that I felt like I was watching you struggle with those two different goals of communicating the sort of deep substance of these political science terms, but also making it readable. I was very impressed with how you struck that balance. Let's start with a brief description of the four threats: political polarization, racism and nativism, economic inequality, and excessive executive power, just to get all of the listeners caught up on these four basic ideas that are important throughout the five periods that you trace.
Right. So I'll jump in here. So political polarization, this is the idea that over time, society and politics becomes divided so that people feel like we're in two camps of us versus them. No longer do we just feel like the people in the other political party are our opponents. Rather, they feel like enemies. And every election and every big policy-making event feels like an existential crisis, where if your side loses, you feel that it's catastrophic, because you think that it has that the future of the country is at stake. And this has been emerging, of course, in the United States over the past few decades. It really started at the grassroots level, probably as coming out of the civil rights era, as white Southerners who had long been Democrats gradually shifted into the Republican Party. But then it was public officials in the 1980s and beyond who tried to, as elections became very competitive, public officials themselves tried to build on political polarization to distinguish themselves from the other party, because that helped them to get elected. And so it's taken both of these forms. And the problem with it for democracy is when, particularly if one party feels like they are going to lose unless they violate the rules of the game of democracy, they'll be willing to do that. They'll be willing to, at all costs, try to win, even if democracy is imperiled. Then the second conflict is what we call conflict over who belongs, conflict over the terms of membership and status, of who's a full member of the political community. And this comes into conflict a lot in the United States over race. I mean, it can also be over ethnicity or gender. But, you know, from the beginning, because of slavery being part of the enslavement of African-Americans being part of the American founding, and you have, you know, an entire group of people who is cut off from full membership because of that. And then this resurges again and again as what scholars call a formative rift, a basic conflict in the United States, that unless we can finally resolve that. We're going to keep happening upon it. And when it emerges, it can create a crisis for democracy if those on the side of keeping existing hierarchies or restoring those from the past are willing to fight for that and at all costs, never mind what happens to democracy. And, you know, we have that kind of conflict now in society, and it's overlapping with political polarization, where the Democratic Party is arguably more than ever before wanting to expand the promises of equality for all citizens, to ensure those promises to all citizens. And the Republican Party has become a party that is much more white than the population as a whole, and has been digging in its heels to try to preserve existing hierarchies. The third conflict is over economic inequality. We've had rising economic inequality in the United States since the 1970s. And what we've learned from countries worldwide is that when the most affluent people are concerned that if the bottom 99% of lower and middle income people gain political power, they are going to enact policies that will raise taxes on the rich and create, you know, regulatory policies that the affluent owners of businesses don't like, then the rich will at all costs try to lock down the existing distribution of resources that benefits them and the political power that's necessary for that. And then finally, the fourth threat is executive aggrandizement. And this refers to the growth and concentration of power in the top leader in the country, in the United States. It's the growth of the presidency, presidential power, relative to executive power, relative to legislative power. And of course, this has been happening in the United States since the 1930s. It's, you know, in the main, this occurs because presidents are trying to respond to broad public needs. But it can become problematic if you have a president who's willing to use those executive powers for their own personal and political gain and to abuse power in the process.
Rob, did you want to?
Yeah. So what's really striking about the threats is that each one of them individually can pose problems for democracy. This is one of the things we learned from our comparative politics colleagues. All of these things are things we know from the study of the rise and fall of democracy in other countries that can pose problems for democracy. What we find over the course of history then is that it's the way these things combine and appear in different combinations at different points in history that really drives the story of the book. And we see, you know, recurring patterns of combinations of threats. And what's really distinctive about the contemporary period is, whereas in the past we've seen one or two or three threats combine all at once, this is the first time that we've ever seen all four converge together at the same time.
As I was reading the book, I wondered whether you had determined the four threats first or you had determined the five periods first. And I'm wondering what the relationship was in determining these four as the threats.
Well, I think the threats emerged, as I said, from our work with colleagues in comparative politics. And from really getting them to help us think about democracy in general and what's made for successful or fragile democracies elsewhere. So I think these are, for the most part, reasonably well-known categories of threats to democracy in the comparative democratization literature. You know, I think as we delved more into American history, we came to a more refined and clear understanding of what they mean and how they express themselves in the United States. The periods was an interesting process. I mean, you know, the periods that we look at, the 1790s, the 1850s, and the run-up to the Civil War, the 1890s at the end of Reconstruction, the 1930s, and then the 1970s and Watergate. Those are all periods when people in the United States had reason to believe that democracy was fragile, or that we were at risk of backsliding, that we were at risk of moving in the wrong direction. And so we very quickly zeroed in on some of these. The 1850s, I think, was an obvious failure of democracy in the United States. The 1790s and the conflict leading up to the 1800 election. Watergate, obviously, was certainly on everybody's mind throughout much of the Trump administration. So that sort of presented itself, obviously. And the 1890s as a moment of dramatic de-democratization as voting rights were taken away from millions of African-American men in the South. The last one that we came to, and the one that I don't think we expected to write about when we started working on the book, was the 1930s, which we often think of as, in retrospect, as a moment of triumph for democracy. The Depression, neither the Depression nor World War II, leading into the Cold War, sort of laid American democracy low. And if anything, American democracy emerged triumphant from this middle of the 20th century period and then on to the civil rights triumphs of the 1960s. But the more we thought about it, and we did have a very critical intervention from actually a former graduate student of mine who was a discussant at a conference where we were presenting some early material from the book. And she said, you know, you really ought to write about the 1930s because as Ira Katznelson has written about the 1930s, this was a period when Americans genuinely and deeply believed that democracy, as they had come to understand it, was under threat. Looking across the Atlantic to the rise of fascism and various kinds of totalitarianism in Europe, looking at the collapse of global capitalism and the Great Depression. So the 1930s was the last period we added. And I'm glad we did, actually, because it really puts some of the stories, especially the story about the growth of executive power, in very sharp relief.
Let's obviously we can't summarize a book of this much detail, but I think that the chapters are so beautifully organized and they are written such that there are big takeaways that I think we can capture for the listeners in the podcast. The first substantive chapter is about the polarization over the Alien and Sedition Acts in the 1790s. So can you take us through, we've had, for example, recently, Julian Zelizer, who's Burning Down the House is about polarization and trying to figure out where it comes from. You have your take. Can you just talk us through a little bit about why the 1790s was of such interest to you and the major things that we should know as citizens and political scientists?
Yes, I would be delighted to talk about this. So the 1790s is very striking. You know, I think that a lot of Americans today assume that the kind of fractiousness we have now is really, you know, the fault of modern society, and that certainly the people who were the founding fathers of this country were well above that. Well, it turns out that's not the case. I mean, if you look at how some of them were talking when the Constitution was being founded, they did not anticipate the creation of political parties, and they thought that such groups would be problematic. But frankly, no sooner was the ink dry on the Constitution, and some of these very same people are governing, then they found it was necessary to start creating political parties. At the time, they didn't call them parties. They were really like organized political factions. But what happened very quickly out of the gate was that there were policy disagreements and disagreements about the vision of how the United States should develop in terms of its economy. And so you had Alexander Hamilton working with George Washington and the Federalists. They became known as the Federalists on the one side, and they, for the most part, were in charge of government. And then you had what emerged as the opposition party, led by Thomas Jefferson and James Madison, and they became known as the Democratic Republicans. And so very quickly, these particular individual leaders were fighting it out in the partisan media, in newspapers that they created, and they would write what were frankly anonymous op-eds, unsigned pieces where they would go after each other and argue about these different policies that they were concerned about. And that was just the beginning in the early 1790s. And then you also had American citizens who were incensed about particular policies. So out living on the frontier in Pennsylvania or close to the frontier were all of these farmers who produced whiskey. And there was a new tax on distilled spirits that was part of Hamilton's financial plan. And they wanted to resist it. They didn't want to pay these taxes. Well, this conflict went on for years. They were doing things like capturing federal tax collectors and tarring and feathering them, which was a form of torture in that era. Eventually, they are starting to make plans, some thousands of them, to try to really storm Pittsburgh and take arms, shut down the mail service. And when the Washington administration catches wind of this, they decide that it's necessary to put down the insurrection. And Washington himself, as president, leads troops gathered from four states, and 15,000 of them. And Washington is on horseback at the front, leading them to Western Pennsylvania to put down the rebels. They get there, and the leaders of the rebels have already fled into the frontier. And so they try to round up a few people, but they have very little evidence against them. And ultimately, all the charges are abandoned. But, that is, this first instance of the federal government really using its power to try to put down an insurrection of citizens. And as the 1790s goes on, you have one conflict after another. And, you get to the enactment of the Alien and Sedition Acts that President John Adams signs into law. And these are a thinly veiled effort to try to suppress the political opposition because they call for the deportation of immigrants from countries that are deemed to be dangerous. And well, that just so happens to be countries where people who are affiliated with the Democratic Republicans are from, France and Ireland. And that it also includes the Sedition Acts, which can be used to arrest people, journalists and others, who are being critical of the federal government. So at this point, after this is signed into law, Jefferson and Madison are incensed, and they go to some of the states where Democratic Republicans are in power, and they encourage those states to adopt policies saying that they will not recognize these laws and they will not administer them. So by the time you get to the election of 1800, both sides are really expecting that this first decade of governance under the new Constitution might be the last, and that the country might, depending upon the outcome of the election, there might be violence, at least, and perhaps a civil war, perhaps secession. There's a deadlocked election, there's, finally a resolution to it. And remarkably, despite everyone's fears, there is a peaceful transition of power, and Thomas Jefferson becomes president. And so it's the first time that there's a peaceful transfer of power from the Federalists to the Democratic Republicans, and the nation carries on. But it was a really polarized decade, and it shows how polarization, even when it's acting all by itself, can create major havoc, and that's dangerous for the extent to which democracy existed at that point. It very well could have been derailed.
It's funny, usually you have to do a lot of work to make the parallels clear as you're thinking about the current period, but it kind of just jumps out at you that you don't have to do very much to see, especially the conflict between the idea of sanctuary cities and resisting what's perceived to be a national law that's problematic. Rob, I'm sorry. I think you wanted to get in as well.
No. The one thing I would add to thinking about the election of 1800, which carries over into the next period, is that one of the things that shaped the outcome of the election of 1800 was the three-fifths clause of the Constitution. Now, this is really important because it gives Southern slaveholding states extra representation. It gives white voters in Southern slaveholding states extra representation in Congress and the Electoral College. Without those votes, without those extra votes, historians have estimated John Adams would have won the election of 1800 and this whole crisis wouldn't have happened. So the whole election is determined on the backs of the three-fifths clause, which then for decades shapes the balance of the party system and inflates the power of the South to protect slavery over the first half of the 19th century, leading up to the next crisis, which comes in the 1850s.
Well, let's move to that next crisis. Certainly the slave power that made Southern states more powerful in terms of policy that was passed in Congress was really important to setting up the context of what happens in the 1850s. So let's move into that disintegration.
Yeah. So what happens obviously this is a very complicated, long drawn out conflict, but over the decades leading up to the 1850s, resistance and controversy over the practice of human enslavement grows around the country. The North grows in size and power relative to the South. And the South, which has sort of hidden behind the three-fifths clause for decades, finds that it increasingly has to reach for anti-democratic tactics in order to protect slavery. A gag rule in Congress in the 1840s, censorship of anti-slavery material, through the controlling the mail in the South as Northern abolitionists are trying to send anti-slavery tracts to people in the South through the mail. This really breaks out into open conflict and really open warfare before the Civil War in Kansas in the 1850s. This is a new territory that's been created by Congress, and the settlers in Kansas go about, white settlers in Kansas go about trying to set up a government, a territorial government, as preparation for being considered for statehood by Congress. And this quickly devolves into conflict between pro-slavery and anti-slavery settlers. So you have a series of disputed elections that are marred by fraud and violence and killing in some cases. And eventually you have a complete breakdown of the idea that there are sort of two points of view and there can be a legitimate opposition. The idea of a legitimate opposition, which is sort of foundational to a democratic system, just completely disintegrates. Those who are opposed to your view become the enemy, quite literally. So you have, as I said, violent conflict between pro and anti-slavery militias. You have at one point essentially dueling sets of elections, two different state legislatures and different constitutions that have been adopted by pro and anti-slavery citizens in the territory of Kansas. And by the end of the 1850s, inflamed by things like the Dred Scott decision, the party system, which for decades, the division between Democrats and Whigs essentially managed to keep slavery off the national agenda, the party system has has been completely reorganized around slavery. So you have a new, increasingly popular anti-slavery party, the Republicans, and a Democratic Party that's still trying to grapple with how to manage its views on slavery. And by the time of the 1860 presidential election, you have essentially two separate elections in the United States, almost mirroring what happened in territorial elections in Kansas earlier in the 1850s. There are four candidates. There's essentially in the North a contest between Abraham Lincoln, the Republican, and Stephen Douglas, who's the candidate of the northern half of the Democratic Party. In the South, you have an election between John Breckinridge, the vice president, who is the candidate of the southern half of the Democratic Party, and a man named John Bell, who's a former Whig who still believed that the Union could be saved. So you have, you know, two separate contests between two separate pairs of candidates. Lincoln wins the election in 1860 legitimately. He won a clear majority of the electoral vote nationwide, a pretty sizable plurality of the popular vote. But Southerners discover that this man has been elected president who didn't even appear on the ballot in most Southern states, and who they saw as an existential threat to the value that they most cared about, which was the enslavement of African Americans. And faced with this choice between accepting the outcome of a Democratic election and preserving their system of enslavement, they chose slavery. And so immediately after Lincoln is elected, even before he takes office, six or seven Southern states secede, form the Confederate States of America. Lincoln has to dodge an assassination plot on his way to Washington for the inauguration. And then a month after he's inaugurated, the conflict becomes the Civil War when Confederate troops fire on Fort Sumter. So you can see in real time the breakdown of these core democratic pillars and values over this conflict.
So once we get out of the 1850s, and we won't go over the war because I think listeners are fairly familiar with it and we want people to buy the book and read it, we move to a period in which Reconstruction and the 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendments in principle and in practice empower newly enfranchised Black men. But your chapter focuses not on that part, but on the backsliding that comes after it. So, Suzanne, I'm wondering if you could just give us some of the main takeaways from the chapter on the 1890s.
Yes, I'd like to do that. I will say that researching and writing this chapter was a big eye-opener to me, and I feel like it's very relevant in terms of understanding the possibilities of backsliding today. So if we look at this period of the late 19th century, democracy was really on the rise, and people who had political rights, which now included African-American men, were very politically active, and the political parties were politically active. You had the emergence of a third party, the Populists, which was an agrarian party, and it was active in the West and the South. And so things seemed to be going quite well, but it was at this very juncture that threats emerged. And the three threats that we mentioned were all, you know, quite high in the 1890s. And I want to zoom in to what happened in North Carolina, because I think it illustrates really well the larger dynamics in the South at that time. So in North Carolina, the African Americans, as they were elsewhere in the South, were voted for Republicans, and they were running for elective office as Republicans. And they then you also had the emergence of the Populist Party in North Carolina. And these two parties would usually get beaten by the Democrats, who were the white party led by business people and other white elites. But what they realized was that if they worked together, the fusionists and the populists and the Republicans, on what they called a fusion approach, running candidates on the same ballot, they could actually beat the Democrats. And that's what they did in various elections in the 1890s. They started to take control of state and local offices in the state. And at this point, the white Democrats decided they'd had enough and that it was time to take radical action in order to shut down the political competition. And so they had a concerted strategy in 1898, where first they took control so that they would do well in the election. They did a lot of stuffing of ballot boxes even before the election. They tried to intimidate Republicans from running candidates and from voting. And so they managed to gain back control of the state legislature. But then 2 days later, they staged a coup d'etat in the city of Wilmington, North Carolina. Now, Wilmington at that time was really a sign of success for African Americans. They were moving into the middle class. They held lots of elective offices locally. And what happened on that one day, November 10th, 1898, is that white paramilitary groups gathered in the morning at the city armory. They marched first to the office of the Black-owned newspaper, and they burned it down. It was the only daily Black-owned newspaper in the nation. They burned it down. Then they proceeded to march into Black neighborhoods, and they killed many African Americans, hundreds, as the day went on. And they also dragged people from their homes, various leaders, and they took them to the train station, banished them from town. And by the end of the day, they forced at gunpoint the resignation of those who were serving in the Board of Aldermen and as the mayor, the sheriff, and so on, and replaced them with their own. So the white Democrats were then in control, in power, and they were statewide as well. And what they did in the months that followed was that they enacted poll taxes and literacy tests, which would subsequently prohibit African Americans from voting. States all over the South followed them. Some of them had actually already acted to enact these poll taxes and literacy tests. So the whole region enacted these, disenfranchising African Americans. And it lasted for 60 years. And, you know, once people had lost political rights, then they lost civil rights and civil liberties as well. And you have Jim Crow set up all over the South. And this rigid system of segregation, which is really like American apartheid. The federal government looked the other way while this was happening, did not intervene despite the pleas of African Americans to do so. What this illustrates is that major backsliding is not only possible in the United States, but it's happened, and it was tolerated for a very long time. And it happened when three threats collided.
Thanks so much. That chapter is really harrowing. And no, I recommend the book to everybody, particularly that part. Rob, I'm going to ask you to do sort of the impossible, which is to cover executive aggrandizement in the 30s and the weaponized presidency in the 70s sort of together so that we have some time to reflect on what's happened since the book is published and the conclusions in the book and the what you're asking readers to think about once they've processed the four threats and the five periods.
Sure. Well, the story of American politics in the 20th century is really largely the story of the growth of presidential power, which is the one threat of the four that really wasn't present earlier in history. And we begin telling that story with Franklin Roosevelt. And Franklin Roosevelt takes office at this moment of deep crisis for liberal democracy the world over. And many people expected him and even were urging him to sort of assume dictatorial powers. He didn't. Democracy survived. But by the end of the Roosevelt presidency, he leaves an office much more powerful, with much greater tools to control politics and policy than when he entered office. Some of this is well known, the growth of the administrative state, the growth of the White House staff. Some of it fails, the attempt to pack the courts in 1937. Some of the things that Roosevelt does some of the things that Roosevelt does have a very dark cast to them. the well-known mass incarceration of Japanese Americans during World War II, but also less well-known in 1940, right before the United States gets into the war, Roosevelt signs a secret memo that's actually authored by J. Edgar Hoover, who was already the director of the FBI, authorizing illegal wiretapping in order to help with counterespionage. Roosevelt was obsessed with Nazi subversion in the United States. So Roosevelt leaves the presidency with a lot of tools that an opportunistic president later on could take up to serve his own personal and political interest, which is exactly what happens in the 1970s with Richard Nixon. The scandal we know as Watergate is really the tip of a very large iceberg of skullduggery that boils down to Nixon trying to use the power and tools of a very strong presidency to serve his own political interests, to go after his enemies and so forth. You know, Nixon is eventually brought down essentially by a bipartisan coalition and by a number of actors playing their prescribed constitutional roles. Congress was on the way to impeaching him, prosecutors, judges, the press, everyone did their job. But this was a moment like the 1930s when executive aggrandizement was really the only prominent threat. The other three threats in these two 20th century episodes were at relatively low ebbs. So, you know, even executive power by itself can do some damage, but it's somewhat restrained when the other three threats are low.
So my colleague, Laura Bucci at St. Joseph's, assigned your book to her students in her elections class. Obviously, it's a new book, so she wasn't really able to, you know, preview it for too long. And I have sort of two questions that come out of my conversation with Laura and also one of her students via Facebook. First of all, as we think about these four threats, I'm wondering what you think about them being as sort of asymmetrically relevant. For example, you know, could we say that polarization is a threat, but that there's some prior cause that's pushing that polarization? And how did you sort of grapple with that possible problem as you were kind of coming up with these, with the assigning of responsibility for the decline? Another question has to do with the student was frustrated with the ending of the book because she thought that there had been incredible clarity about the four threats, but she wasn't sure what was now to be done. What were the next steps? And I also had a question about neutrality. I think the book works really, really hard to show this as something that came from various different parties. So sometimes you seem very, very neutral about assigning the responsibility. But I'm wondering in the 21st century, as you're taking that apart, the extent to which you see this as a both sides and whether you can sort of elaborate a little bit on that, like what happens. Is it the case, as some as capital D Democrats would like to think, that it is the Republican Party that is practicing this kind of scorched earth politics and they're trying to maintain institutions and practices? Anyway, that's a lot of different questions, but it's a way of leading into the conclusion of your book, and you can pick and choose as to which of those you answer. It's been a while since you put this to publication. So really, what is it that you think should be the takeaway for the reader, and what did you conclude after looking at these five periods?
Well, I think that, you know, what we really learned in writing this book is that American democracy has been fragile at many times in the past. And, you know, coming of age and growing up in the late 20th century, for the most part, things were fairly calm. And so we could be lulled into the idea that American democracy is secure and it can't be fundamentally endangered. But looking at the past, one realizes it's actually been in danger time and again, and sometimes major backsliding has occurred. And that could occur now as well, and we're not immune to it. So that's our big takeaway from it. And one of the things we haven't talked about that I want to highlight is we were really looking at, in any given period, how much damage occurred to any of what we call the four pillars of democracy. And these are free and fair elections, the rule of law, the legitimacy of the opposition, and the integrity of rights. And sometimes they were endangered, but there wasn't really damage. In other instances, like the 1890s, there was lasting damage to really all four of those. And so when we're looking at the contemporary period, that was, you know, what we were looking at. And so we saw that, you know, the four threats, as I mentioned at the beginning, have all been on the rise for some time. To the question of, you know, whether both parties are responsible, political polarization has emerged in a dynamic. Both parties have exacerbated it. But what we found ultimately in looking at the contemporary period is that it is the Republican Party which has been willing to do things that endanger these four pillars of democracy. And that's been happening particularly in the last 4 years, and especially in this year of 2020 with at an accelerating pace. And, you know, now in the wake of an election, going into the election, the Republicans were taking all sorts of actions to try to prevent people from voting, even in the midst of a pandemic, and now challenging votes in the wake of an election, and Trump's unwillingness to concede is a violation of the legitimacy of the political opposition, that when a party wins election, they win the right to govern and all that goes with it. And the losing party needs to look to the next election to try to win again. And meanwhile, the rule of law has been violated. President Trump has been using the Department of Justice as if it's his own personal law firm, relying upon Attorney General Barr to support his claims of, you know, illegitimate votes in the election, and to go after these, to pursue these frivolous lawsuits. Much to the, you know, chagrin of many longtime employees of that department who have worked in this area for a long time. So you know, that's a great concern to us. And so we do think that this is a time when Americans need to take very seriously the need to bolster these four pillars of democracy. Trying to scale back the threats is really ambitious, and that's hard work. And political scientists, you know all too well that once polarization is raging, there are no simple fixes to that. But in the meanwhile, so that this political competition can happen and conflict can happen without democracy being undermined, we need to strengthen the pillars. And so that's really our conclusion.
Yeah, and I would add to that, you know, I think the question about the sort of prior causes of polarization is a good one. But what we focus on is less the causes of polarization than the consequences of polarization, especially when it occurs in conjunction with other threats. When the parties are polarized, when they're really at odds with each other, and when, as Francis Lee has shown, when parties are really competitive, then the strategic demand of distinguishing yourself from the other party, your team from the other team, becomes really important. That dynamic can then be exacerbated and deepened in the presence of these other threats, particularly conflict over membership, race or immigration, for example, or economic inequality, which gives polarizing politicians, and this has been happening particularly in the Republican Party in the last few decades, gives polarizing politicians the opportunity and the means to target the other side and to unite their voters and to mobilize voters and to you know, create these antagonisms. So it's that sort of cascading dynamic of polarization along with other threats. And then on top of that, you know, a very powerful presidency in the presence of polarization gives presidents, again, the means and the opportunity and the motive to use these very powerful tools of an out-of-control executive establishment to target the other side.
Rob, when you talk about means, and I had this thought as the book progressed, I was wondering what you think about communication and the fact that the things that have been in play were there. You talk a lot about the different types of media that were present in all five periods and the role that they played and the fact that they were at many times biased. But I'm wondering if you see any differences in the means of communication that also creates a kind of faster moving threat to democracy in the period that we're in currently.
I think it's the faster moving. This is not an area where I have particular expertise, but I think it's the faster moving element of communication now that's the new feature. I mean, as you said, pretty much all of these periods feature some kind of partisan press. The 1790s had these newspaper wars. Each of these factions, the Federalists and Republicans, had their own newspaper that, as Suzanne said earlier, were full of these anonymous sort of screeds targeting people on the other side, often very personal. So the idea of the press as this sort of neutral, investigative, fact-finding pillar of democratic rectitude that we're familiar with from the, say, middle and late 20th century is sort of an artifact of that period of American history. What I think is new is the speed with which, you know, you through social media or the sort of 24-hour cable news cycle, that these ideas, partisan ideas and misinformation can take hold and spread. And we're seeing the consequences of that play out right in front of our very eyes here in the middle of November, watching all kinds of crazy stories about the election scatter throughout the country.
Well, I think we could talk about this forever. The book is so rich, the examples so thought-provoking. But I want to remind listeners that we are talking about the recurring crises of American democracy. Sorry, four threats, the recurring crises of American democracy. I'm going to say that again. Four Threats, The Recurring Crisis of American Democracy, published by St. Martin's. What are the two of you working on? What are the next projects that we can expect to see coming from either you individually or together?
Well, I've been starting on a project about the rural-urban divide in the United States today, which has really been on the rise over the past quarter century. And I think that it's driving polarization and that it has all sorts of implications for democracy. So that's what I'm getting immersed in right now.
And I'm at the beginning of a project with my friend and occasional co-author Desmond King on the history of race and what we call the civil rights state. It's almost the flip side of this book in that we're looking and trying to understand a period when democratization actually advanced in the United States, the period of the Civil Rights Revolution after World War II, and trying to understand what it was that allowed the American state to transform itself, at least temporarily, into a protector of equal status for African Americans.
Well, those both sound fascinating, and I hope when you're done, you'll come back to talk to us at New Books in Political Science. Suzanne and Rob, thank you for the book, and thank you so much for the conversation and your time today.
Thank you, Susan. I really enjoyed it.
Thanks so much for having us. It's been a pleasure.